Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the nationwide rash of police shootings and altercations involving the use of force against minorities, from a Texas pool party with teenagers to a video of officers killing a Boston terrorist suspect to the unusual intervention of African American community leaders in Cleveland, distrustful of the criminal justice system in the case of the shooting of a 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who have invoked a rarely used Ohio law asking a judge to charge two Cleveland police officers with murder. Vernelia Randall, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, and author of Dying While Black, joins us to discuss these and other incidents. Then we look into the political instability in Turkey following parliamentary elections that left no clear winners and no apparent roadmap to forming a governing coalition. Sona Çağatay, the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a regular columnist for Hurriyet Daily News, joins us to discuss what possible ruling coalitions could be formed following the electoral rebuke handed to President Erdogan. Then finally, we'll speak with Rob Sisson, the former mayor of Sturgis, Michigan, and president of the Conserve America, formerly Republicans for Environmental Protection. We will discuss the $175 million pledge by a North Carolina businessman to the GOP in the hope that the current Republican Party, that is skeptical if not hostile to climate science, will accept the reality of climate change and find market-based solutions to stimulate green energy. And joining us now is Vernelia Randall, Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio. Her writings are at her website, which is racism.org, and Professor Randall is the author of the book Dying While Black. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vernelia Randall.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And today in Cleveland, eight clergy members and community activists filed court papers seeking the arrest of two Cleveland police officers involved in the November shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice. And each of them filed affidavits under a rarely used Ohio law asking the Cleveland Municipal Court judge to find probable cause to arrest Timothy Lohman and Frank Gombach on aggregated murder, murder, involuntary manslaughter, reckless homicide, negligent homicide, and dereliction of duty charges. So given that just a few days ago the inquiry was sent, the investigation into the killing of Tamir Rice was sent to the prosecutor, is this a double track, or how do you describe what's happening?
Well, it seems to me that what is happening is that there's an attempt to avoid having the prosecutor reject a trial, waiting for the prosecutors to reject filing charges by using this law before that. So I think that the courts will need to rule on this without regard to what the prosecutor ultimately does. Certainly, if the court denies their complaint, the prosecutor can still bring charges.
And clearly, there is a lot of distrust of the criminal justice system in the African-American community across the country from the New York case of the grand jury that did not indict any of the police officers in the death of Eric Garner, which was captured on videotape. And then, of course, Officer Darren Wilson got off for the fatal shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. So that's the environment in which we're talking about. But Timothy McGinty, the Cuyahoga County prosecutor who's considering the Tamir Rice case, he also just recently lost the trial against the policeman Michael Brello, who fired 49 shots at a couple in a car, 15 of them from the hood of the car once it had ground to a halt after over 100 shots were fired at the car. What's your sense of him? Because he actually criticized the judge in that case. He felt that the judge basically lost the case for him. Go ahead.
I think he My sense is at least from how he has pursued this other case, that and he's actually filed a complaint in court to have the legal rulings corrected, because he does believe that the judge misapplied the law in that case. I don't know. I don't have a sense of whether what he would do with the Tamir Rice, the prosecution of that case. But I do think he did only bring one charge against one set of police in the other case, and he could have brought more charges against police who were involved. So I have to wonder about that.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Elliott Randall, who's Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio, and Professor Randall's writings are at her website, racism.org, and she's the author of Dying While Black. So just broadening out the conversation to the national stage, if you will, Vanellia, I mentioned the Texas pool party with the teenagers captured on video, where it was a white teenager who videotaped it, and he went on CNN and said the police did hassle any of the white kids, say anyone after the black kids. And you saw the video of the policeman kneeling on and pushing the face of this 14-year-old, a young African-American girl, 14, who's in a bikini. And that policeman apparently just resigned today. And then you had the recent, I think it was yesterday, that the video was released of the officers killing a Boston terrorist suspect. So what's happening in the broader context of the nation? Why do you think police are appear to be getting more and more trigger happy?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think police are affected by the same things that the rest of society affected by, which is there's an anti-black bias in American society. 80% of white people have an anti-black implicit bias, and 40 to 50% of black people have an anti-black implicit bias. So because of the media, because of the way everything is structured, most Americans have an anti-black bias. So you start with that. And then you lay on top of that the drug war and the war on terrorism. I really think that in the last 15 years, police are being trained differently so that they can be at the forefront of the war on terror on the United States ground. And I think that aggression, that part of the training that is happening is for police to shoot first and ask questions later. And I think on top of that, police departments are hiring more and more people who are returning from the military who have that kind of military training. So we have police departments that are really military, pseudo-military departments, and I think that's what is happening. And that, as an African American, one of the things we know is when there's a problem in society, generally oppressed groups like African Americans and Native Americans and Latinos feel that oppression first. And so I think that's at the root of what's happening.
Well, it does seem that if you do recruit, and police departments across the country do recruit lots of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we know from their experiences, the various documentaries and news footage that we've seen from those wars, that that these soldiers look upon all the civilians in the neighborhood where they're patrolling as potential enemies. Any moment they could be a sniper could shoot at them, or an IED could blow them up. So I think it's reasonable to assume that some of that psychological baggage goes over to patrolling the streets of America. But in the case of the Boston shooting, and there's a great deal of evidence that this fellow was influenced by Islamic State propaganda, nevertheless, it was a joint sort of anti-terrorist task force of FBI and local police. So there you have actually the local police already working on anti-terrorism. So that certainly buttresses the argument that you just made.
Well, one of the things that I read, and I can't remember the exact number, but a number of large cities, including New York, actually are being trained in Israel, and actually have offices in foreign countries. So we have local departments that are acting as extensions in other countries to do investigations, to collaborate with them. And I do think that we do have a trigger happy force. The Guardian, which has started the countdown of the number of people killed by police in the United States, and is a British paper, it has started putting out comparisons of the number of people killed in other countries compared to killed in our country in one day. And so I think that we have to find a way to back off of using police as sort of terror fighters, because when they do that, they see citizens as expendable, and that's what's happening with the African-American community. They're fearful. How many times have we heard them say, "I was afraid, I was afraid, I was fearful"? And they act upon that fear without regard to what the underlying facts are. Tamir Rice, 12 years old, playing in a park. John Crawford in a Walmart holding a toy gun. And so we see this over and over again, where the police are shooting at people, killing them, and mostly black and brown people and Native Americans. And whites are being killed too, but not in the same proportion to the population.
So in terms of what has changed here, we've talked about a lot of the connection between both the military training of a lot of police officers who've been recruited out of the pool of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. We also saw a lot of heavy military warlike equipment, battlefield equipment, with police forces, particularly in Ferguson. And the president recently did move by executive order to curb that Pentagon giveaway program to police forces. You also had in Albuquerque in January, the prosecutor charge officers with murder for shooting and killing a mentally ill homeless man. And in Baltimore, six officers were indicted last week for the reckless endangerment and murder of Freddie Gray. And of course, just yesterday, a former police officer in Charleston, South Carolina, was indicted on murder charges in connection with shooting Walter Scott in the back, which we all saw, pretty much all of us saw on video. So there is do you see that as at least a change? Is this because of the pervasive nature of social media and the accessibility and proliferation of cell phones?
Well, I think definitely the proliferation of cell phones has made a difference in how people are responding. It'll be interesting to me see whether there's a conviction, because part of the problem is that the underlying law that juries are going to be instructed on requires them to look at the situation from that particular individual's point of police person's point of view, and not a reasonable person, not a reasonable police officer. So it's a very subjective standard. It's not whether or not a reasonable police officer would have been afraid, a reasonable police officer, which is a defense to all charges. It would be whether this particular individual police officer was afraid. And, of course, who can argue with that? The other problem I have is that it's not enough to charge a few people. It seems to me that fundamentally, when police officers, we have some police officers, whether or not they're charged with crimes, it should be unacceptable behavior, and they should be fired and lose their pension. It's sort of like you don't have to be charged with a crime for a police department to say it's unacceptable for you to kneel on the back of a 14-year-old child and behave the way you did. And no, we're not accepting your resignation. We're going to finish this investigation. And if we see that you violated our policy, we're going to fire you. The gentleman in Texas has resigned with his pension. And so that's another one of the things that we need to change. The other things we need to change is taxpayers need to stop paying for these settlements that police officers are doing. I'm not saying that people shouldn't get the settlements. I absolutely think they should. But like every other profession, lawyers, nurses, doctors, police officers should have to carry liability insurance, which covers their misbehavior. And right now, they don't. In many places, police officers don't carry liability insurance. The city just covers it. I think that if police officers had to pay for their own liability insurance, that would make them cognizant of when these claims have to be paid out. They would be more sensitive to that happening because their insurance would go up.
Well, just in closing, though, it seems that here in Hollywood, where I'm talking to you from, most of the TV shows are about police, and I've talked to a number of policemen who have, throughout their long careers, have never fired their guns. But in Hollywood, in the movies, and in television, they fire their guns all the time. In this case of the 12-year-old boy, Tamir Rice, the 9/11 caller said the gun was probably fake. But you know from the movies that there's an adrenaline rush when they're rushing to the scene. And when these two policemen arrived, the Timothy Lomond, who shot Tamir Rice, he shot him within 2 seconds of arriving. Yet, exactly. Of course, he's claiming that he followed procedure and tried to warn Tamir three times, which was, of course, in that time frame is physically impossible. So that we'll see what happens with that case, I guess.
I mean, I think it's a novel idea of them using the law, and I'm so happy that they did. Mm-hmm. I think that it will put a counter pressure on the prosecutor to move forward, and we'll see what the municipal court does with it.
Well, you know that this policeman, Timothy Lerman, was fired from a local suburban police force outside of Cleveland for reckless behavior and with weapons and apparently what they detected as mental problems or psychological problems, I should say. And yet the Cleveland police hired him.
And I think this is one of the big issues that the police departments that have problems, one of the things they do are they lax on refusing to accept people who clearly have problems. And I think this is that Cleveland's probably not the only place that is doing that, but they certainly should have a database, and more than a database, it seems to me that if you are fired from a police department, you should lose your license, your ability to be a police officer. So as part of the problem is not just that Cleveland hired him, but he was capable of being hired. He was still capable of being licensed in the state of Ohio.
Well, but in terms of interacting with mentally ill people, which happens a lot too, we've had shootings here and a very brutal one here in Orange County, which was again captured on videotape. The poor guy was screaming for his father as they beat him to death. Obviously, there has to be the police aren't psychologists. You know, we have to have better mental health care and not just dump these people on the streets.
Well, I mean, I remember in the 80s when they closed all the mental hospitals down and turned them back and turned people out of the hospitals, supposedly turning them back in the community where they were going to get better care, but not funding the care. Yeah, no, police aren't psychologists, but they are first responders. And any first responder, whether it's police, ambulance, or fire department, should be able and skilled in handling mentally ill people. Or they shouldn't be first responders. They should not go. If someone calls for help because they're having a person who's having a mental health breakdown, the police should not respond if they're not capable of dealing with the situation. And that's not about them being psychologists. That's about knowing how to de-escalate a situation, deal with people who are having mental health issues. And one of the big groups that is being killed, white or black or whatever, is people who are having mental health disturbances, even when it's clear that they are at no risk to themselves or to others.
Well, Vannelli and Randall, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Vannelli Randall, who's Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton, Ohio. Professor Randall's writings are at her website, racism.org, and she's the author of Dying While Black. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the political instability in Turkey following parliamentary elections that left no clear winners. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, 'cause you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, 'cause we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. There's a little truth. Open up your eye while you're checking out the boombox. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sona Chaptai, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics and is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sona Çaptay.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian.
And this was quite an upset, Turkish elections, parliamentary elections. On the weekend, there was a sense that the AKP, President Erdogan's party, was unstoppable, but that didn't happen, did it? That was a real surprise. Was it a surprise to you?
Indeed, I think AKP underperformed even the most conservative poll estimates, whereas the liberal Kurdish alliance and the opposition, one could say, outperformed even the most liberal estimates. So this was quite a surprise. But what is even more important is that for the first time in 13 years, President Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, also known as AKP, lost its parliamentary majority. So they won't be able to form government unless they build alliances with other political actors, something they didn't have to do for about 13 years. So Turkey's entering a new and unfamiliar political terrain.
So I guess the same is true of the opposition, though. It's going to be difficult for them to build alliances with the National Action Party being anti-Kurdish.
Absolutely.
It's hard to see them joining with the People's Democratic Party or the HDP, Kurdish party.
The Kurdish liberal bloc and the Turkish nationalist bloc have about equal number of seats in the parliament, both coming up with 80 in the 550-member legislative. And these are two political parties that could never do together. So when you look at the mathematics of the new legislator, it's really difficult to see how they could form a majority government supported by majority legislators. The three parties, opposition parties, have ruled out joining forces with AKP. So long as Erdogan, the AKP leader, President Erdogan, does not relinquish his control over the party, they say. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. And the left and the right do not have a tradition of forming coalitions in Turkey, though I would add that if the largest party, AKP, and the main opposition, secularist leftist Republican People's Party, CHP, were to form a coalition, that could probably be a dream government in Turkey in the sense that it will be bringing together Turkey's disparate halves together, the secular liberal bloc and the conservative Islamist bloc. They're both large constituencies with significant economic and demographic bases. And the benefit of such a grand coalition would be that the two sides will learn to work together to reach social consensus, but also the idea that Turkey belongs to both of them and one just won't leave. That would require a tradition of grand coalitions, which Turkey does not have. The country typically does not have right-left coalitions. It has right-right or less left coalitions, and that leaves us with very few plausible combinations that could bring forth a government that could receive vote of confidence in the parliament.
But isn't Erdogan, at least he has indicated lately, and there's no question that he's had a very good run, and the country's had a very good run under him, but lately he's become what you can only assume is sort of megalomaniacal with that vast palace he built for himself and his intolerance. And quite often he's almost childish in his angry response to criticism.
What has happened in the last 10 years, Ian, is the following story. Erdogan came to power with a promise of clean government. But what really helped his party win three successive elections until this past Sunday was that they delivered phenomenal economic growth and good governance in terms of improving the country's urban and transportation infrastructure, building high-speed rail lines, new subway lines across Istanbul, making lives, people's lives easier, but more importantly, improving standards, making Turkey a majority middle-class society. When Erdogan came to power, Turkey was a country of mostly poor people. Now it's a country of mostly middle-income people. When he came to power, infant mortality rates in Turkey out of 1,000 babies was 36, which is comparable to Syria. Now that rate is 7 out of 1,000 babies, which is comparable to Spain. So the Turks live better off as a result of Erdogan's legacy. And that's what has delivered him electoral gains. But he's also decided that now he wants to become a fully powered executive-style president, controlling all three branches of government. And Turkey is a parliamentary democracy, and his party ran on a platform of shifting the country's system from a parliamentary democracy to a fully presidential system, U.S. style, with Erdogan on top. And what happened on Sunday, I think the electorate said no to that. The AKP lost significant number of votes. Its support came from nearly 50 down to nearly 40. It also lost its parliamentary majority. So I think when given a not necessarily binary choice between prosperity and freedoms and liberal democracy, the Turks ultimately voted for liberal democracy. So that's going to be interesting to see how Erdogan takes that message now and whether he comes back even stronger because Turkey is entering a period of coalition governments which could benefit him or the opposition parties.
And again, I'm speaking with Sona Çağatay, who is director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and he's a regular columnist for Hurriyet Daily News. So I was mentioning, though, that he appears to have gotten a little drunk with power. I mentioned the palace, but also he's gone after the Gulenists, who certainly aren't, as far as I can tell, subversive. They're certainly not violent in any way, but he's almost been vindictive towards them. And I'm wondering whether it's possible that he's the kind of personality that could coexist in a coalition of the AKP and the Secularist Republican People's Party.
Well, in the earlier times when Erdogan came to power, his platform was inclusive. He reached out to not just his usual base of conservative Muslims, but to broader communities. And I think that is what carried this party to the center. But perhaps that's a time, that's history for Erdogan's legacy now, because that's about a decade ago. I think it would require a significant amount of political maturity on his behalf, on behalf of, as well as the secular opposition party, to get together, because while that coalition of the left and right, the two largest parties coming together, is the least plausible, because the country does not have a tradition of coalitions across the political aisle, it's probably the best for the country in terms of political stability, in the sense that it would probably avoid elections for the time being, as well as diffuse some of Turkey's existing social tensions over religion and role of religion in politics, which divides the left and the right. But at the same time, I think that Erdogan has a pretty large base. Let's not forget, his party is still the largest party. He has not won majority in the parliament. His party cannot form government on its own, but it still controls nearly a majority of the seats, barely 20 short, and he has 40% support. So the question is, should Turkey enter a period of political economic instability? Because that's often the case when coalition governments or minority governments are formed in Turkey. Would this benefit Erdogan's party? Would the AKP come back even stronger? Would the electorate then decide that once again they'd like to pick a single party government, because Turkey does much better politically and economically under single party government? The beneficiary of that viewpoint will be AKP. So he could come back if he plays the game well. He could also lose it if the opposition paints the AKP as a problem for any kind of instability that could follow up. And I think the question, therefore, is really going to be who plays the political game of coming out clean and blaming the other side for what could be lying ahead in Turkey.
But is that to say that the AKP would benefit from a period of instability and economic downturn? How long would that last?
Nobody wants economic instability and downturn in Turkey. I think everybody wants to avoid that. But politics is also the art of staying in power, and I think it does require the parties to be Machiavellian. So one alternative could be a right-right coalition where the governing AKP builds an alliance with the Nationalist Action Party. That party comes also from the political right, and the AKP and MHP voters are pretty similar. So there will be a natural fit, but it would also mean that the AKP would have to give up on Turkey's peace process with the Kurds, the Kurdish Nationalist HDP, and that would anger the Kurds. So the question would be, would Erdogan take that step of a firm, safe terrain of a right-right coalition? Of course, he would not only be angering the Kurds, but also the liberals who have entered the parliament, which is a huge development in Turkish politics. For a long time, people would have thought that liberals did not really exist in Turkey. Of course, you found them in the largest city in Istanbul. But outside of that, that political thought did not have a followership in this largely Muslim country. The election results have proven that argument incorrect. This party, which ran on a liberal platform, it filled it members of Turkey's ethnic, political, and religious minorities, openly gay candidates. Half of its people on its list were women. It has Armenian deputies in the parliament now. This was a very liberal message, and about 13% of the country's population voted for it, nearly one out of six. So Turkey definitely has a liberal force to be reckoned with within the ranks of the Kurdish Liberal Alliance and also within the ranks of the other leftist party, which is the Republican People's Party, CHP, which is, in a way, an indirect result, unintended as it might be, in my view, of Erdogan's successful economic policies. It's his economic miracle that has made Turkey a middle-class society, a majority middle-class society, that is, and that majority middle class is now making some very middle-class men. So ironically, they're supporting the opposition and not his party. So the more he's successful economically, perhaps, the more he's building his own opposition.
But this new liberal party that you're talking about, that's inside the People's Democratic Party.
This is an alliance with the Kurds, so it's inside the Democratic People's Party, and there's also a large number of liberal deputies within the Republican People's Party, known as CHP. So it's the first time, I would say, the Turkish parliament has a significant number of liberal deputies represented in the two leftist parties.
But surely these are the people that would be most concerned by Turkey's drift away from secularism into a more Islamist society.
Absolutely. And I think this is really a scenario that's not happening for the reasons that Turkey's too diverse, too big, and economically it's $1.5 trillion inside the world's 16th largest economy. It's 77 million inhabitants, and it's an incredibly globalized society. 97% of Turkish citizens are literate. Before the end of this decade, at the rate it goes, with literacy increasing 1% point, Turkey will be universally literate. It will become the world's first large Muslim society that's universally literate, and those societies cannot be ripped apart so easily from global society. So I think Turkey's long-term future is fine. The question is, in the short term, of course, it may suffer through economic and political instability because it's entered this unfamiliar terrain of coalition government. It doesn't matter who's in charge. Turkey's political system just does not do well when there are coalition governments in charge. That's because internal bickering ultimately brings down the government. Early elections are called for. That has happened many times before. In fact, if any decade that historians would look at and identify as decades of low economic growth and political instability are usually decades of coalition governments, such as the 90s and the 70s. And as opposed to that, all decades known as decades of economic growth and stability are decades of single-party government, such as the last decade under AKP, or the 80s, or the 50s. So now we're entering a new decade, if it goes like this, of coalition government, though early elections could bring forward an alignment of a new set of circumstances that could help the AKP come back again as a strong single-party government, should the electorate decide to vote for that again.
But the surprise party, the People's Democratic Party, the HDP, that did so well, largely Kurdish, but as you mentioned, a whole group of liberal, secular people
Absolutely.
Have joined in it. Given its secular nature, wouldn't it be a fit with the secularist Republican People's Party? Could they form a coalition?
No, because the two leftist parties could not form a coalition, even if they wanted to, because numerically speaking, when you add them up, they don't get enough seats in the parliament to get a vote of confidence, which means they'll be lacking a parliamentary majority. So left-left coalition is not possible.
I see. So your scenario would be, the most likely scenario would be the Nationalist Action Party, MHP, joining in with the AKP.
The most likely scenario is an AKP-MHP coalition, bringing together the two right-wing parties.
And that would take the country further to the right, though?
Though that would require a condition put forward by the MHP to be satisfied that Erdogan should take a step back from his current position, where he acts like a de facto executive president and assume his powers, which are more like a ceremonial presidency. That's really hard for Erdogan to swallow, so that may not happen as well. The most likely scenario, I think, is a minority government led by the largest party, supported by outside parties, depending on issues, and that's probably not going to be a long-lasting government.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sona Kapte.
It's my absolute pleasure.
And we've been speaking with Sona Çağatay, who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations and Turkish domestic politics, and he is a regular columnist for Hürriyet Daily News. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the $175 million pledge by a North Carolina businessman to the GOP to get them to take climate change seriously. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rob Sisson, who's the former mayor and city commissioner of Sturgis, Michigan, and president of Conserve America, formerly Republicans for Environmental Protection. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Sisson.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And a Republican businessman in North Carolina has pledged $175 million to push the party towards accepting global warming seriously. I take it he's not alone. You're quoted in an article mentioning a number of Republican funders, and some of them may even be kingmakers. So walk us through the list of who's on board climate change and who's working to get the GOP to take it more seriously.
Sure. Well, I think I would be negligent if I didn't point out Conserve America first. In fact, this is our 20th anniversary as an organization dedicated to restoring the GOP's great conservation tradition and ethics.
Which started with Teddy Roosevelt, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, you know what? Abraham Lincoln, the first Republican president, is the person who protected the area that is now Yosemite. First time ever land was set aside for future public enjoyment. So, long history. Since then, a number of organizations have been founded to address these and similar issues. There is the R Street, which is a think tank in based in Washington, with a libertarian perspective. The Energy and Enterprise Institute, which Bob Inglis heads up at George Mason University, of course, is one that many people are familiar with. And then there are a number of Taxpayers for Common Sense, some faith organizations like the Catholic Climate Covenant, Evangelical Environmental Network, that are working in the conservative side of the political spectrum on climate change and other issues.
So tell us about this fellow, Jay Faison. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Jay Faison, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I know a little bit about Jay. I've met him one time. His family was in real estate. They sold the company. Jay went on himself then to found and build a few technology companies. So he's been immensely successful. And he's decided that the Republican Party needs to, you know, reclaim ground that they've ceded to Democrats by and large the last 25 years. And so he set up a foundation called Clear Path that, from what I understand, just from the public record and reading articles, will be doing some of its own programming and also doing some doing grants to other organizations to work on policy and advocacy and education. And then today there was an article that made the rounds where he's going to invest some money into the political action side of the overall climate effort.
But in terms of the 2016 Republican presidential race, is there anyone that you could support and that Jay Faison could support apart from Lindsey Graham?
Well, you know, I will not single out individual at this time, and I don't know if Jay would or not either, but I do know that five or six of them have actually acknowledge climate change, the science, and have begun discussing in the course of either their campaign or their, you know, their nationwide tour to determine whether they're going to campaign or not, this issue. So this is a vast leap ahead of where we were 4 years ago. You know, Lindsey Graham, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey, George Pataki, former governor of New York, and Rand Paul have all acknowledged climate change as being a problem that we need to discuss and address. So I'm very optimistic that it will be part of the Republican dialogue over the next 18 months.
Well, I don't think you can say that Jeb Bush has a full-throated endorsement. He was fairly careful and equivocating, wasn't he, that it could be caused by man and it needs further review. And, of course, Jeb Bush has decried the arrogance of those who say climate change is settled. That's not exactly the consensus of the scientific community.
Well, I think I've read some statements from him over the last couple of months that are pretty solid on the issue. I think a lot of the equivocation we're seeing out of Governor Bush's effort or process here is dependent on who his audience is and trying to frame a message for that particular audience. And I think we just saw that his campaign kind of rebooted over the weekend. So I look forward to seeing what kind of, you know, seeing a more consistent message on climate and environmental protection from Governor Bush as he makes his rounds.
And again, I'm speaking with Rob Sisson, who's the former mayor and city commissioner of Sturgis, Michigan, and president of Conserve America, formerly Republicans for Environmental Protection. So in terms, though, of the fundraising landscape, which nowadays, of course, billions are required to become a president, and for that matter, many millions to become senators and many millions to become congressmen. But most of the attention on the Republican side has been with the Koch brothers and their fairly deep pockets. Tell us about who are some of the, apart from Jay Faison, there's a fellow called Andrew Sabin in New York. He's apparently been trying to influence the Bush family on climate change. I take it that there must be some people working more quietly than the more, I'm not sure that the Koch brothers want publicity, but they're certainly getting a lot of it.
Right. I think the number of Republican donors who are investing in a climate message or a conservation message are much fewer than those are donating for other purposes, whether it's in opposition to the Affordable Care Act or for tax policy or jobs, fossil fuel investment, things like that. But there are some out there, and I hesitant to name names because that just creates a lineup of people knocking on their doors. But there are a number of very wealthy, very intelligent Republicans sprinkled on boards, not only some of these conservative groups that we discussed earlier, but also some of the bigger, better known, you know, old line environmental or conservation groups. But I think the Koch brothers and it's their network, you know, in our country have the right under current law and case law to try to get their message out and make their point, and regardless of how much money they spend. But what we found in the 2014 election cycle is through our own internal polling that a good majority of Republicans would support a Republican candidate leading or acting on climate change. And so it's through some of this polling and education and sharing that information with candidates, I think, how we can use less investment for pro-climate action on the Republican side of the aisle to offset, you know, the hundreds of millions being spent by, you know, the Koch network.
And, of course, on the Democratic side, you've got Tom Steyer's Next Gen Climate Public Education campaign, and he's put money into Democratic campaigns. How much do you, as a Republican, feel that you're playing catch-up here?
Well, yeah, I don't know if we're playing catch-up, but we finally have Jay Faison as a great example. We have someone who finally recognizes that, you know, the party's at risk if we don't become realistic or adopt a realistic position on climate change or other other environmental issues. You know, it was in 2002, 2004, where the pollster Frank Luntz advised the Republican networks that we were most vulnerable in elections to Democrats on the issue of climate change because the science had become more certain. But there was still an opportunity to mislead or sow some confusion and continue to be competitive in races. And I know there is some proprietary polling in existence that has made the rounds in Washington and elsewhere that shows that the Republican Party in general is in trouble 2 years out, 4 years out, if we continue this institutional obstinance when it comes to climate science. So I think just as Frank Luntz had such an impact on the direction of the party and the messaging of the party a decade or 12 years ago, I think some of this new polling that has been done in the last couple of years and will be done in this next cycle undoubtedly will help inform the messaging. And I think these presidential candidates we listed off before, the five or six, probably have polling in hand, and they see that the talking about climate science is not going to be a negative for their campaign. In fact, it could distinguish them from the other, you know, 15 or 16 people running. So, again, I'm very optimistic that some of these presidential candidates will actually, you know, knock down the wall of silence that we've had for the last decade on climate.
So when Jay Faison talks about a market-based approach as opposed to government mandates, what does he mean? Is there an example that you can point to?
You know, I don't know what he has in mind, but I know that some people would suggest, in fact, Exxon would suggest that a carbon tax would be a market-based approach, a revenue-neutral carbon tax, because you're actually putting you're pricing the externalities of the product, and that will then create a market mechanism to divert capital and consumer preference to other sources of energy. You know, there's an effort kind of going on right now to roll back the clean energy or renewable energy standards that several states have. But really, that's when you put a renewable energy standard in place and then just leave it to the market to figure out how to get there, that also is a form of a market-oriented solution. But I think that the major key for Jay's effort and that of groups like Conserve America is really convincing Republican office holders and candidates that it's safe to talk about climate science and it's safe to talk about what America should do to lead the global effort on reducing greenhouse gases.
Well, of course, the first country to adopt a carbon tax was Australia, and that was actually praised by Al Gore as one of the great steps forward, and then the new Conservative government in Australia repealed the carbon tax. So it hasn't had much success, at least in that case, but what's your sense of where it stands in the United States? I mean, I think a lot of our listeners would be hearing for the first time that Exxon was in favor of a carbon tax, and we know that Exxon's got a very large corporation, so it's got some political clout. Who's leading that argument on the conservative side?
Well, I think here in the U.S., we look to Bob Inglis, the issue that he spends all his time and energy on is talking about a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Art Laffer and several other economists from the University of Chicago School of Economics have weighed in on this and have done some work on it. So there's a number of people that have worked on it. Some of the conservative think tanks have actually done some work on it. You know, there's the political issue in D.C. where so many of the currently elected officials have signed the No New Tax Pledge, and the folks that have asked people to sign that pledge interpret that meaning even if it's revenue neutral, you're still creating a new tax, and that's verboten under this pledge that you gave us. So there's some political a lot of political groundwork yet to be done in Washington and elsewhere to get people to the comfort level. Now, when I say ExxonMobil they're not actually campaigning for it. They're factoring, I think it was $60 a ton in some of their projections for the future. And they have on their website, they have a climate change greenhouse gas section on their website that any of your listeners can go to and look at and see what ExxonMobil says. So they're pretty clear on it.
Well, just in closing, how, since you're clearly in the business of trying to propagate this message that the Republicans were the first to, in effect, invent conservation here in the United States, and your organization, Conserve America, formerly Republicans for Environmental Protection, you must be sort of, you know, talking to Republican donors. And how are you received when you make your pitch?
Sure. It's actually, there are two audiences that I normally talk to, and it's bifurcated by age. The folks that are 45, 50 and older, when I talk to them and talk about the Republican heritage, and I go through the great litany of Republican conservationists with Lincoln, U.S. Grant created Yellowstone, and then Theodore Roosevelt, which, you know, everyone hearkens to. You get this, like, softening in their faces and a smile and say, I forgot that's part of my party's heritage. I've been so involved and roiled up over these partisan issues that have come up over the last decade or so that I just completely forgot that the Republican Party used to be the leader and the voice of common sense on this. And then when I speak to younger groups, particularly college Republican chapters, they've never heard, they're totally unaware of this. It predates them. They know about Teddy Roosevelt a little bit, but not too much. But when I go through the great history and legacy of the party, I've had leaders of college chapters say, we can triple our membership numbers by just sharing this information and talking about conservation in the Republican Party on campus, because there's so many people that love to hike and kayak and bike and bird watch, whatever, that would otherwise be Republicans, but they think we're against that. We're against nature or natural resource protection, but we're not. So the reception is always really, really good when I talk to people. And I've been doing this for 9 years now, and there are times when things ebb and flow, but right now, given people like Jay and Andy Sabin and these presidential candidates talking about climate science, I'm extremely optimistic now, and I really believe that we're close to a tipping point where we'll get more and more people in Congress to talk about this and actually act on it.
Well, just in closing, in today's New York Times, there's a full-page ad with a picture of the endangered African elephant, and it's a call to protect the endangered species, and most urgently, the African elephant that's facing extinction along with the rhinoceros. And I noticed on your website that your logo is the elephant, so that's kind of personal, yeah. Isn't it?
We chose the elephant because it's the Republican Party symbol, but ours is slightly modified. Ours is a raging elephant.
Right. Well, but you don't want a dead elephant, do you?
No, we don't.
So that, what did you think of the ad?
I have not seen it.
So check it out.
I will.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Rob.
Yeah, thank you, Ian. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Rob Sisson, who's a former mayor and city commissioner of Sturgis, Michigan, and president of Conserve America, formerly Republicans for Environmental Protection. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.